Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives as investigators discuss current management and actual cases of relapse refractory metastatic colorectal cancer. We have a great faculty tonight, Dr. Kristin Siomber from the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and Dr. Randy Hecht from the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine in Santa Monica, California. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all of our webinars, there's a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of our meeting here tonight. We do webinars all the time. We've been doing it ever since the beginning of the pandemic. Tomorrow night, we're going to be tackling a really interesting, evolving story, the systemic therapy in the management of localized non-small cell cancer, not only neoadjuvant immunotherapy, but also targeted therapy, osimertinib, and maybe ALK coming along as well. On September the 26th, we'll be doing a program on refractory mantle cell, pirtobrutinib, CAR T-cell, where do BTK inhibitors fit in. We'll be starting a series on gastroesophageal cancers on September 28th with Dr. Enziger. And then we're going to be doing a program on something we haven't talked about in a while, non-melanoma skin cancer, particularly checkpoint inhibitors, on October 3rd. Then the first two Saturdays of October, we had all-day meetings, first in Orlando with a Florida cancer specialist. We'll be covering a bunch of tumor types, and I have a bunch of investigators. And then the next Saturday, we'll be in Las Vegas for the American Oncology Network meeting. They're covering some additional tumors. So between those two, we have about 30 investigators over those 2 days for you to, if you're in that area, to check us out live or check it out online. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Phillip on some of the papers presented in GI cancers from ASCO. But here tonight, we're here to talk about metastatic colorectal cancer. And as we do in a lot of webinars, we're going to be presenting real cases from docs in practice, general medical oncologists and community-based practice. I sit down with these docs for hour and a half. They present CLL, myeloma, bladder cancer. But tonight we're going to hear a bunch of cases of metastatic colorectal cancer. I met with both of our faculty in the last couple of weeks to record a presentation. If you go in the chat room and click on it, you can see it now, and we'll be emailing it along with this webinar once we get it put together. These are in-depth discussions. We review a lot of papers. Kristin reviewed a bunch of papers, particularly looking at later stage disease, talking about fruquintinib. We'll get into that a little bit. EGFR rechallenge, and of course, TAS-102 and then new data on TAS-102 plus Bev. We'll be getting into that tonight also. Randy got into a lot of targeted topics, BRAF, HER2, which is something we're going to talk about here tonight as well, and some new approaches to disease, and also, of course, management of BRAF patients. So we really recommend you check out these presentations. But tonight, what we're going to do is try to take it to the next level. We've got 8 cases from docs in practice and one that was emailed to me from Germany. Mm. We'll throw in on top of that. Mm. We're going to talk about taking care of patients, where things are today, and where things are going to be heading. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the cases, Randy, this is a slide from your talk, kind of providing an overview of some of the targetable mutations that we're now addressing in this disease. Fortunately, we've gone beyond chemotherapy. You've always had a leadership role looking at testing. Can you just sort of summarize the common targetable alterations we're looking for, what we're thinking about for the future, and also your take of where liquid biopsy fits in, Randy?
Yeah, thank you, Neil. So colorectal cancer, we've been doing testing, not as much as our lung cancer colleagues, but we've been doing it for a long time, going back to when we were first looking at anti-EGFR and looking at RAS mutations. So we learned about RAS mutations as telling us what not to do, treat patients with anti-EGFR. And now things have exploded because we have a number of different targets that we could possibly, we have drugs for. Some we might, we might in the future, some we have now. So most of the testing historically has been tissue-based, And before, there were small panels looking at RAS and maybe BRAF and HER2, or just RAS alone. Now things have gotten much broader panels with NGS. And the people who are watching this are familiar with NGS, not just for colorectal cancer, but for other cancers, looking at 600, 700 different genes. Those tend to actually correspond reasonably well with the more, with the smaller panels for RAS or for BRAF or for HER2. But more and more people are also using ctDNA or liquid biopsy. It's easy. You don't have to track down the tissue. You might be able to get the results back faster. And actually my colleague, Dr. Siambor, is familiar with some of, I think, really important data from the Mountaineer trial, showing that maybe at least in some things like HER2, this may not be, quite ready for prime time. So the targetable lesions that we look for, everyone is always looking for those patients with MSI. Those are the patients that do wonderfully with checkpoint inhibitors, but it's only about 3% of patients. I always say I'm working for the 97%. BRAF is more common, particularly the class 1 V600E, 5 to 10% generally bad. HER2 amplification is present about 5%, and we can talk about that now that we have several drugs that either are approved or at least available. I'm still looking for my first NTRK fusion patient. And RET fusion, I haven't seen at all. People are familiar with G12C, particularly from lung cancer. About 3% of colorectal cancers have G12C. We used to write down KRAS mutant. Now we have to start writing down what exactly is the mutation. So we've been doing sort of large surveys of our charts to identify patients. And unfortunately, often it just says RAS mutant. And then what I said was aspirational really are the 50% of patients that show up with a RAS mutation. In fact, as you get to later lines, it gets to be higher, that there are a lot of studies out there for RAS mutation. So we're not quite lung cancer yet, but I think we're hopefully the majority of our patients may have potential targetable lesions.
So, Kristen, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. And as you see second opinions of people who've been managed in a community-based setting, any sort of, I'm not going to say errors you see made, but things done that maybe you wouldn't do, are people actually in practice getting this? You see all these real-world studies out there. Sometimes I wonder how accurate they are. Is it your sense right now that patients are getting worked up appropriately, Kristen?
Yeah, I think we've definitely seen a shift over the last few years, in particular, as we see more truly actionable alterations. I heard a lot from the community prior to many of these new targeted agents being available, that it really just wasn't that helpful to send NGS, and it was a little bit of a pain. But I think some of the workflows are now better, and the turnaround time for testing is better. And truthfully, oftentimes it's more efficient to send for NGS than to do now these individual tests, like testing for KRAS and BRAF and MSI and everything else. So I think across the board, practices change. I think more people are going towards NGS, which is great.
All right. Well, let's jump into these cases. We've got 8 cases here tonight. We're just going to sort of touch on some of the key issues to bring in sort of a real world aspect to it. And these docs have quite a few questions. But first, I got this email from a doc in Germany who follows our webinars, who has a patient wanted some feedback on a 40-year-old woman who's got a metastatic disease of the liver and lung. She's got a KRAS G13D and HER2 overexpression. She's progressed on TAS-102, now getting FOLFIRI ramucirumab, and wants to know about TDXD despite the KRAS mutation. And Kristen, the first case that we're going to talk about on the videos is also a HER2-positive case with a KRAS mutation. And I know it's not that common, but both of these docs want to know sort of what's new. We're going to kind of get into more, the available strategies, but at least in terms of implications of testing, are we still, having this sort of idea that if there's a KRAS mutation, they won't respond to anti-HER therapy, or with these newer agents, are we seeing that they do respond?
Yeah, it's a great question and something we've been wondering for a while. And at ASCO, we actually saw the first prospective data, I think, that patients with KRAS mutations can respond if they're HER2 amplified. So that was the DESTINY-CRC02 study specifically looked at patients who were KRAS wild type and KRAS mutant, so different populations of patients, and really saw in the subgroup analyses that patients treated with T-DXd or trastuzumab deruxtecan, the antibody drug conjugate for HER2, everyone can benefit. So that was very nice to see because most of the other studies had only included patients who are KRAS wild type, who admittedly are the more common patients. It's about an 80-20 split of RAS wild type versus mutant in the HER2 overexpressed patient population. So I think that was a very practical takeaway from DESTINY that we can give these patients anti-HER2 therapy.
So, you know, actually, Randy, you know, thinking about Kristen's comment about people are much more motivated to order markers because now they're seeing, you know, some therapies that really can help patients. And I think certainly when people are seeing anti-HER responses all over oncology, obviously breast cancer, but also lung cancer, gastroesophageal cancer, and as we're going to talk about a colorectal cancer. This is a situation, too, where, as you can see, this patient's willing to pay for therapy. He wanted to treat her, or she wanted to, the doc wanted to treat her with T-DXd. The insurance wouldn't cover it, and the patient says she'll pay for it. What's your global impression about sort of the, before we get into the specifics about which agent and when you do it, Randy, do you view HER2-positive disease, kind of a metastatic colorectal cancer, as sort of a treatable disease, a disease where, you know, patients can respond to therapy and stay in response for a reasonable period of time?
I think it all depends on your point of view. In fact, there was a recent opinion in a kind of a online journal called STAT. And what we consider to be, you know, a good response is not necessarily what our patients hear. And the problem, having worked in signal transduction inhibitors for more than 20 years, now we're ecstatic when someone has, you know, we have a median, you know, progression-free survival of 5 months. And that is clinically significant. That's not what the patients hear. And so the great news is that some people can do well. We were discussing cases before. Some people can do well for a long period of time. This patient here, for example, is 3+, and those are the group of patients who did best with T-DXd, and people were 2+ and ish positive. They had benefit, but they didn't do as well. But still, you know, this 40-year-old woman wants 5 years, 10 years to be with her kids. And so so these are worthy drugs. They're helpful. And I think this is what I'm saying is I think they're useful tools. I wouldn't call it a treatable, you know, disease yet. Treatable disease is like imatinib and GIST. And this is not like that, but it helps people.
Yeah, that's a great point. Although I think, you know, when you think about people with metastatic disease and, you know, the goals of therapy that are very different than, you know, maybe other people's, and, you know, be able to induce a response that, you know, again, will make improve quality of life and allow people to enjoy their life for a while seems like a very important
worthy goals. Goal. Yeah.
I remember when I asked you this question during our session, Kristen, you said you really emphasize people who overexpress. Have you had patients who have, you know, long, even if you look back at the older therapy, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, do you see, you know, sort of breast cancer-like HER2 responses in this disease?
Yeah, so that is one difference between colon cancer and breast cancer, where, and certainly I'm no breast expert, but where you can see benefit from the anti-HER regimens with very low expression or even, you know, not amplified. That doesn't seem to be the case in colorectal cancer, where the response typically is concordant with the level of overexpression. So as Randy mentioned, you know, the 3+ patients are the ones who are benefiting the most on a, you know, in general from all of these regimens. And you know, as a practical tip, when I get NGS reports and I see that, you know, ERBB2 amplification, I will actually go back and ask what the copy number is, because that's not always reported. And that will give me a sense of how likely this patient is to respond.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's start making rounds here. We have an 81-year-old lady who's a patient of Dr. Lamar. Here's the case.
I saw an 81-year-old woman who presented with a partially obstructing mass in the ascending colon. She underwent a right colectomy, and pathology from the procedure confirmed adenocarcinoma with 10 of 23 lymph nodes positive. Following surgery, I saw her for the first time, and I recommended more imaging because her initial imaging wasn't conclusive to me. And unfortunately, it confirmed multiple liver metastases and lymphadenopathy in several nodal regions. This particular patient is KRAS mutant and HER2 positive. I started her on FOLFOX with the plan of adding bevacizumab once I have her anemia under control. Would you consider HER2-directed therapy in the second-line setting for her, even though she is KRAS mutant? I'm really interested in learning more about your experience with trastuzumab and tucatinib in patients with metastatic colon cancer.
We were also talking before about your experience with T-DXd and breast cancer and the evolving encouraging data in HER2-positive colorectal cancer. Was NGS testing done?
I did next-generation sequencing, and it showed the presence of KRAS G12C. Sotorasib has been approved for KRAS G12C and non-small cell lung cancer. Do you have any experience using this medication in advanced colon cancer?
So I'll start with you, Kristen. Maybe you can comment on how you're thinking through second-line therapy and HER2-positive colorectal cancer in the metastatic setting. And do you think it through differently in a patient nowadays who has a RAS mutation? Do you think it through differently in an 81-year-old than a 65-year-old, in a patient with pulmonary problems versus somebody who doesn't have pulmonary problems? Can you kind of give us, and do most, are you thinking that most people are going to end up getting both of the newer exciting options, T-DXd and the Mountaineer regimen?
Yeah, so I think, you know, with a KRAS mutant patient, I think really the data is really with T-DXd, and I think that would be reasonable, even an 81-year-old, though you do have to be careful with the toxicities because they can still be significant. Interestingly, the NCCN guidelines, of which Dr. Hecht and I are a part, you know, for a while now have actually said for if intensive therapy is not recommended for whatever reason, whether it be age or performance status, that you can still treat with anti-HER2 regimens, so per expert guidelines. So you could have maybe even considered that first. But if the patient can tolerate 5-FU-based therapies, that was certainly, you know, a reasonable thing to do. But at the current time, I would do for that patient T-DXd and consider that. Now, I would do the lower dose, the 5.4 mg per kg, again, based on DESTINY-CRCO2 recently presented at ASCO, which looked at the difference in response between the 5.4 and the 6.4. And the 5.4 really looked less toxic and just as good, if not better.
Are you, anticipating your patients are going to end up getting both of these regimens? For example, if you start a patient like this on T-DXd, maybe they respond and they progress, would Mountaineer be next?
Yeah, so for the RAS wild-type patient, I actually would start with Mountaineer first, so trastuzumab, tucatinib. The toxicity profile is actually quite good. Patients can have prolonged responses. I mean, the median overall survival is extremely long, 24 months. And there were several patients with complete responses, actually, and are still on therapy years later. So that's really exciting. And then you know, the other thing about trastuzumab deruxtecan is that it showed efficacy even after prior anti-HER2 regimens. So, you know, there were about a third of patients who had already had anti-HER2 therapy who went on to DESTINY-CRCO1, and they still responded. So I think that's a nice sequence for the RAS wild-type patient in which you do have both options. And then, you know, because there is that small but real toxicity of interstitial lung disease with trastuzumab deruxtecan, you know, maybe using that later might be preferable just to you know, avoid that toxicity earlier in the patient's course.
Mm-hmm. Randy, any thoughts about this algorithm? Of course, you know, these two cases are probably picked because they were different. You know, most people are not KRAS mutated who are HER2 positive. But do you agree that in a KRAS, you know, let's say non-debatable situation, could maybe debate the other one, but in a KRAS wild type, are you generally going with Mountaineer before T-DXd, Randy? Or there, if the patient is fulminantly ill, would you be more likely to consider T-DXd?
You know, if you look at the response rates, particularly this patient was 3+, the response, you know, when they looked at like Destiny CRCO2, there was a mixture of the 3+ and the 2+, but at least if you separate out the 3+, response rate was actually pretty high. So, I mean, I think that either one would be, you know, kind of reasonable. We're always, the other thing that maybe it's a little bit unfair is that we usually have trials for these patients, and we also have other HER2 trials right now. The only other things I would bring up is one, the physician held the bevacizumab because she was worried about anemia, and really bleeding is not very common with bev. You know, that was in the original, you know, we were afraid of bleeding with bevacizumab, so I don't think that's a reason not to do it. The other thing, which I think is really interesting, is the patient had a G12C mutation. So we were talking earlier about, well, what do we do with HER2-directed therapy in the person with the RAS mutation? But I haven't seen it the other way around. What do we do with a person who has 3+ amplification who happens to have a G12C mutation? So you have something that you have two relatively rare things going on at the same time. And I have no idea, you know, Kristen, maybe you have some, but what would be the effect of HER2 amplification if you were giving such a patient, let's say, you know, adagrasib or sotorasib? I think they might be more likely to be resistant if they have, because HER2, at least for EGFR, and you should be combining it with an anti-EGFR. So this is a really, Neil, you managed to find a really interesting uncommon case with this.
Very uncommon. I've never seen that particular combination, actually.
So, Kristen, you were very involved with the Mountaineer study, and of course, this was approved earlier this year. Can you comment a little bit about what you learned from that study? Pretty impressive waterfall plot in the initial study, not too much benefit with monotherapy. And can you comment a little bit about the findings in the Mountaineer trial?
Yeah, I think the takeaways there were from Mountaineer was really the very good response rates, even in the highly refractory setting. So 38% response rate. And then, as I mentioned, median overall survival of 2 years, which this is after all prior lines of therapies, for patients on average to live an additional 2 years at least, is really incredible. And as I mentioned, there were some CRs there too. The other nice thing is it's a very tolerable regimen. So, you know, some GI side effects and fatigue, but really very few grade threes on study. And that's been my clinical experience as well. So overall, we've been pretty happy with that regimen, and patients have been too.
So, Randy, any comments? We've been talking about T-DXd. Of course, again, we talk about a number of other cancers, and you mentioned the ILD. I'm curious how you approach screening for ILD. In breast cancer, they're pretty aggressive. They use imaging. Even if patients don't need the imaging, they image the chest regularly, of course, ask for symptoms. How are you approaching this, Randy? And what do you do if you have a patient with pre-existing lung disease?
Okay, let me take those one at a time. So one is that, you know, are actually the general oncologists actually are ahead of us because they're used to using this drug from breast cancer. So it's actually training the people who are like us, who are GI oncologists, because this is, you know, even though we managed to learn about lung toxicity, for example, for checkpoint inhibitors, we also have had to learn about lung toxicity for T-DXd. And I think it's mostly just the first thing is a heightened suspicion in someone who has cough or, you know, or shortness of breath. One of the things I thought was interesting, and Kristen mentioned about the Destiny trials. And remember, a lot of these were done in GI cancer places. Not all, but they were done in GI cancer patient places. And in the CRC 02, the incidence of grade 5 death, you know, pulmonary toxicity, while there was one in the higher dose, the 6.4, there was none in the 5.4. And I think it's not just the lower, it's not just actually the lower dose, but I think it's just training people to look for this. And so I think that now, you know, probably a lot of the same centers did it. They know about the pulmonary toxicity. They listen to their patients if they're having cough or shortness of breath, and they have a very, very kind of low threshold to getting scans.
And you were talking before about the data, looking at response rate based on what kind of HER2 staining they have. And, of course, we saw at this ASCO meeting, the CRC-02 study. You would think this ought to be approved. It seems like it's very helpful. I guess you're using it in any event, and I think seeing responses. We're going to get to the KRAS G12C. Dr. Rudolph in the chat room has got questions about that, but we're going to get to that in a second. We have another case. Anything else you want to say about the use of T-DXd, Kristen, in terms of efficacy, in terms of what you've seen, and whether you think it's ever going to be used in HER2 so-called low as it is in breast cancer?
Yeah, I think DESTINY-CRC01 really showed us with the different cohorts that this really doesn't work in the patients who are not truly overexpressed. So that does matter a lot. I would say T-DXd seems a little more versatile in the sense that, again, you can use it in the RAS mutant or wild type population. You can use it after prior a different anti-HER2 regimen. So you can actually think about sequencing at that point instead. So toxicities are a bit more chemo-like than, say, the Mountaineer regimen. So I think there are pros and cons.
All right, let's go to another case. This is a patient of Dr. Azzi, a 78-year-old man.
78-year-old treated with total neoadjuvant therapy, FOLFOX and chemo radiation, and then had surgery with YPT3, YPN1A. Eventually relapsed, started on FOLFIRI bevacizumab, progression after about 6 months, switched to FOLFOX bevacizumab with progressive disease. Molecular testing done by tissue testing and also liquid biopsy showed a KRAS G12C. At that time, I was able to submit an appeal and get sotorasib and panitumumab approved for him. However, we were only able to show some decrease in tumor markers. So my question would be, if and when this regimen gets approved, would that be a regimen our faculty would go to in second or third line?
So, Randy, you talked about this in your talk. Can you kind of review what we know about KRAS G12C?
So G12C is found, once again, in only about 3% of patients with colorectal cancer. That's why we were surprised to see the HER2 positive and the G12C at the same time. It's actually much more common in lung cancer, which is where the approval was. There are two drugs, adagrasib, which is the Mirati drug, and both as well as sotorasib. And there doesn't seem to be huge differences between them. Now, single agent with these, so sort of pretty modest activity. And however, with combining with anti-EGFR, seems to make these drugs much more active. And this is actually, the slide is from the Crystal One, Rona Yeager presented a little bit more activity, though it's, once again, these are relatively small studies and they're not comparison, a little bit higher response rate. But what you can see is that you go from a PR or a total response rate of 19%. To 46% when you add an anti-EGFR. And in some ways, it's like BRAF, where there seems to be signaling through the EGFR pathway and blocking that, whether it's with panitumumab or with cetuximab. I don't think it makes any difference, though the trials were done for various reasons with one or the other. Panitumumab is made by the same people who make sotorasib, so it made sense to combine those. But I think that's really the way that this physician actually treated the patient this way. Now, these patients generally were salvaged. There are trials that are underway. There's the Crystal 10 trial, which I'm actually part of, which is looking, bringing this, into second line. So it's FOLFIRI plus FOLFIRI plus or minus a VEGF receptor inhibitor. So that's the control arm, because some countries don't, it's harder to get a VEGF receptor inhibitor. VEGF pathway, inhibitor, that's versus adagrasib plus cetuximab. So I think this trial, which hopefully will be you know, completed and out sometime soon, will actually answer that question is, do we bring this up at least to second line? So back to your question, Neil. If this is positive, the answer is yes.
Kristens, what's your take on this? You know, this particular case, the patient didn't seem to respond all that great, but I mean, that waterfall plot looks pretty decent. What's your take on sort of the benefit that patients are going to get out of this type of strategy with this doublet?
Yeah, I definitely think the doublet is certainly better than monotherapy, as we find, you know, we can't get away from anti-EGFR and monoclonal antibodies in colorectal cancer. So we need it in BRAF, now we need it in KRAS G12C, so those aren't going away. But what I would say is, you know, the responses are across the board. I've seen some very nice responses to this combination too. So the problem is, as with anything, resistance develops. And, you know, so the duration of response may be relatively short in some patients. And I think that's our next challenge is to, you know, because multiple mechanisms of resistance tend to emerge, being able to account for that and treat the patient beyond that is going to be the next challenge.
All right, let's go to a couple more cases. This is from Dr. Rudolph and Dr. Patel. Dr. Rudolph has a 58-year-old man with a KRAS mutant metastatic colorectal cancer and now progressing on second-line FOLFIRI, but progressing very, very slowly. The patient's very stable. She's concerned, but the patient's doing very well. She's not sure whether to switch. Dr. Patel's patient is KRAS wild type, has already had an EGFR antibody, and is progressing on third line therapy. The question there a little more complex because we have the potential maybe for retreatment, but here are the two cases.
This is a young, excellent performance status with an ECOG 0 African-American gentleman who was diagnosed with right-sided metastatic colon cancer with liver metastases. He also had subcentimeter lung metastases at his initial diagnosis. Fortunately for him, he has a very slowly progressive disease. His lung mets increase in size by no more than 2 to 3 millimeters every 6 months. And he's really maintained an excellent performance status with no symptoms whatsoever. But every single time I see his scan, I have to stop and ask, am I doing the right thing by continuing him on the current treatment, or should I be switching him over to, say, for instance, TAS-102, BEV, or regorafenib? Also looking ahead with possible fruquintinib being approved, which is a VEGF inhibitor, how does that sequence into, now that we have with Sunlight trial benefit of TAS-102 with bevacizumab, would there really be role for fruquintinib after use of TAS-102 bevacizumab?
Young male, found to have metastatic colon cancer. My question for the specialist is, are you using TAS by itself, or are you combining it with bevacizumab? How would you choose between regorafenib and maybe TAS? How would you go about with dosing? And I know with regorafenib, the side effects can be very difficult to manage.
So, and we have one more case I'm going to show you, the same, you know, third, fourth line type of questions. Each one of these cases is different. These are two young patients. The next one I'm going to show you is 82-year-old. I was watching your face, Kristen, as Dr. Rudolph was presenting, and I could see you sort of nodding your head like, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Any thoughts about these cases?
Yeah. So, I totally sympathize. I know that feeling of seeing that slowly progressive cancer and wondering when's the right, you know, is the patient benefiting or should I switch? You know, is it holding it, you know, slowing it down and just not holding it back enough? So that can be a really difficult clinical decision to make. I would say, you know, it does sound like the patient might be a good candidate for TAS-102 BEV. So the Sunlight data, you know, before pre-Sunlight, we used to think that TAS-102 and regorafenib were pretty similar in terms of benefit. which was fairly minimal, incremental, I should say. And then with sunlight, both the phase three sunlight as well as the earlier phase data, we really saw an improvement with the addition of bevacizumab. And for the patients who can tolerate bevacizumab and don't have a contraindication, which frankly, most patients can tolerate it, is that it really does make a difference and it can be fairly tolerable. So I don't think that would be an unreasonable thing to switch to for Dr. Rudolph.
So, Randy, any thoughts about these cases? Also, the issue, I can't remember which one of you talked about the issue of retreatment with EGFR antibodies, but maybe we can just bring this up right now. So any thoughts about these two cases, Randy, and also your comments on retreating with an EGFR antibody?
So first of all, I agree 100%. We always have these patients. And one thing I think that's really important is to make certain that you actually look at when you started your treatment, because it's what I call CT scan creep. And so that, you know, it was 5 millimeters and each one is a little bit more. Well, now it's 2.5, you know, centimeters. And that probably is, that's real progression. And I'm lucky because at UCLA, they just always do it as if the patient were on a trial. So I get my target lesions measured, and that's cheating because also when patients are being outside, no one ever does that. And insurance may send one place one time and another place, and that becomes hard. But I think it's important to say, don't just look at the previous scan, because that's all the radiologist did. As oncologists, we need to. The only other thing that I would take from that, so if that's the case, if it started at 0.5 centimeters and now it's 2.5, it's time to change. And the other thing that is important is burden of disease. If you're worried that you're at a point where the patient progresses, you know, their performance status may fall off, it's near something critical, that would be another reason to change. Not because even the sunlight data, the response rates weren't quite as high as in the Pfeiffer initial phase two, but that's always the case. But overall, patients did well, and they tended to have stable disease. The only other thing that I would say out of this, even though all our trials in second line are with FOLFIRI, I'm not certain how much 5-FU adds. And so I often use just irinotecan alone. It failed. There's no synergy. The other question you asked about retreatment, a lot of this comes from the Italian group. And that what happens is that you probably select out with anti-EGFR treatment, you select out resistant clones. And if you lay off of it, sort of like with antibiotics, then the wild type clones can basically overgrow again. And there are a number of ways. Some people just wait a time, particularly if someone had a response initially, a durable response, and then retreat. Others are using ctDNA to look for resistance mechanisms for them to go away. So if you still have RAS, you know, mutations in the blood, you may want to wait a little bit more.
So let's bring in another case, and then I want to take a look at some of the data you've been talking about. Again, now we shift over to the older patient who's in the third and fourth line setting. This patient ended up getting a TAS 102 without BEB. Here's Dr. Brenner.
This is an 82-year-old gentleman who presented with metastatic disease with bilobar liver metastases. He had reasonable functional status, and we did genomic profiling of his tumor. His TMB was 10. The questions I have for the clinical investigators are, we often in patients who are chemotherapy refractory have to choose between TAS 102 and regorafenib. And the question is if there's any rationale or data for preferring one over the other, and any data regarding gene sequencing data to help us make this decision. The second question is, what is the best way to dose TAS 102? I sometimes run into problems with neutropenia on the standard 5-day on, 2-day off, 5-day on schedule. And I've more been following the regimen that was published by a Japanese group where it's given every 2 weeks for 5 days at a time. And I think I find that a little easier for patients. I was also wondering if the clinical investigators are using that regimen at all. How important is it to add bevacizumab to TAS 102, especially in patients who have received it in 2 prior lines of therapy? Are there any studies in colorectal cancer targeting non-KRAS G12C mutations? And will fruquintinib be approved in colorectal cancer?
A lot of people in the chat room asking about fruquintinib also. So, Randy, any comments on dose of TAS-102 that he was asking about? Yeah. Also, he mentioned that patient had TMB of 10. Would you at any point entertain Pembro?
No. All right. So let me first start with the dosing part. I actually don't. I know people who've been doing it. I just don't personally have. Kristen, maybe you do experience with the every other week. Usually we just kind of dose reduce.
Yeah.
And so, I have to be honest, I don't generally run into that much problem with the, with the neutropenias, but I know that that's out there. But I just say personally, I don't. That was an interesting question about TMB. So first of all, TMB or tumor mutational burden is measured a number of different ways. So one problem is that your TMB is not the same as my TMB. But this, the original sin that goes back was actually in lung cancer, where the, that TMB actually meant something from it meant something biologically, whether someone was going to respond to a checkpoint inhibitor. In colon cancer, the answer is no. And there's actually a good series that's from Memorial. And when they looked at patients with colorectal cancer from this large group of patients who had TMB high, 10 or higher, and the only ones that had any benefit were patients who were POLE and POLE-D. And they tend to, one clue for that, their TMB is not 10. Their TMB is really high. And so I would say that, and in fact, this is in the guidelines. If someone has a POLE or POLE-D mutation, which often should be pulled up in your NGS, then that patient will probably has a pretty good chance of having a response to a checkpoint inhibitor. Those are rare. If you just have the standard run-of-the-mill TMB of 10, that a PD-1 or a PD-L1 is toxicity without benefit.
I just heard something I never heard before. There's something called POLE-D. I've heard of POLE-E. I'm not even going to ask you about POLE-D because I want to ask Kristen about the sunlight study that I think maybe is a little more relevant or more common situation, but interesting. POLE-D. So let's talk about some. I'm tempted, but let's move on. Can you just comment a little bit about this phase 3 trial, Kristen? I think it gained a lot of attention and really affected, I think, people's view of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sunlight was a phase 3. It was a global phase 3 that randomized patients to TAS plus or minus bevacizumab. So this was at the standard dosing, the 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off of TAS. And interestingly, about 3/4 of the patients had prior bevacizumab or really any anti-VEGF therapy. So it was the majority of patients had prior lines to answer that question. This seems to continue to benefit patients even after receipt of multiple lines of bevacizumab. But what we saw here was that overall survival and PFS benefit were very consistent. The nice separation of the curves, about 3 months in terms of overall survival. And when you look, of course, this is cross-trial comparison because we don't have head-to-head data of TAS versus Rego, really, and especially TAS-BEV. But if you look at the overall survival numbers, you 10.8 is quite a bit more than we saw with the monotherapy trials. PFS also was about doubled, more than doubled. And as Randy kind of alluded to before, we still don't see a lot of responses, but it is more. We do see more with the combination of BEV at about 6% versus less than 1% with TAS alone. And the nice thing is the disease control rate is higher. And I think that's something that we see in the clinic quite a bit, with about 3/4 of patients really benefiting, even if they don't have true response.
So everybody's asking about fruquintinib. You heard a couple of the docs ask about it as well. You had this really cool graphic looking at various targeted agents. And in my simplified mind, it looks like regorafenib is a slightly different location than fruquintinib. So first let me ask you, because I know Randy hasn't actually used fruquintinib. You can give me all the phase 1-2 trials you want. I just want to talk to somebody who's actually used the drug and who's used regorafenib so they can, compare it. Because I think in a lot of people's mind, they're thinking there's a comparison there. So, Kristen, what's the deal with fruquintinib in terms of efficacy, but particularly tolerability?
Yeah. So, fruquintinib is a TKI, and it has you know, regorafenib has more of a dirty TKI, so to speak, more multiple targets really of what it's hitting. But fruquintinib was tested in FRESCO 2, which is the global phase 3, randomizing patients to fruquintinib versus placebo. And so fruquintinib was a very similar dosing schedule to regorafenib in 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Interestingly, and something important to remember is that every in the FRESCO 2 study, everyone had received prior bevacizumab or anti-VEGF of some sort, and about 50% of patients had received either TAS, REGO, or both. So this is a little bit of a more refractory patient population than sunlight, for instance. And so I think that gives us a hint of where this should be used, at least for now, with the current data that we have. And I would say after, you know, TAS and regorafenib. Of course, it's not FDA approved yet, so we'll have to wait. The PDUFA date is end of November, so we should know by the end of the year whether this will be FDA approved, hopefully. But FRESCO 2, even in this highly refractory patient population, did show overall survival benefit of about an additional 2.5 months. And PFS was better as well compared to placebo. In terms of my clinical experience with it on FRESCO 2, I actually felt like it was a very tolerable drug. You do see some hand foot, some hypertension, but we're pretty good at managing that. But in general, I think there are fewer toxicities than regorafenib in terms of the classes of toxicities. And maybe that has something to do with the difference in mechanism.
I mean, it wasn't too hard for people to figure out what the problems with regorafenib when it first came out. Of course, everybody was using the high dose, so that made it even worse. But, yeah. You know, what you've been describing to me about what you've seen in these patients, it seems like it's better tolerated than regorafenib. Why would you want to give it after regorafenib?
Well, it's a good question, to be honest. And I try to stay with where the data are. I do think that in the future that you know, maybe combinations will be explored and it may move up, you know, of course, this is kind of exploratory, but what I would say is that on FRESCO 2, not everyone received regorafenib. So I could see the case where people use TAS-BEV first, and then if available, go straight to fruquintinib. You know, regorafenib, some people have success with the redose dosing, which is what I use, and you know, it is an additional line of therapy. So I think that will be up to the, you know, what the label says. But I can envision where people may choose fruquintinib after TAS-BEV.
Randy, any thoughts on this? I feel like I sit down with general medical oncologists and hear cases. If I sit down with an oncologist for an hour, for sure, I hear cases. For sure, I'm going to hear a couple cases where they've used something they never used before. I mean, it happens like almost every day. There's so many options out there. So if the day comes and when they wake up in the morning and they look at their phone and fruquintinib is approved, what are you going to be doing that day, Randy?
I have to go with what Kristen said, which is that, you know, you go where the data takes you. So I think there are two parts to that. I think what all these, the rhyming is VEGF inhibition. So sunlight, VEGF inhibition in patients who'd already failed bevacizumab or something similar. Regorafenib, sort of the same place. Fruquintinib, maybe better tolerated regorafenib, but also VEGF inhibition, even in people who failed VEGF inhibition. So the question is, why? I don't know. Maybe you somehow upregulate other pathways that you have to keep tamped down. So I would probably use, back to your question, I'd probably use fruquintinib before I used regorafenib. I know that's a little bit beyond the data, but in patients who are off trial, and many of these patients would go on study for a couple reasons. One is because salvage patients tend to be frailer and have more, you know, not be as able to tolerate side effects. And as you were just saying, that it's, you know, not cross, you know, cross trial comparison, but it does seem to be, in your personal experience, it seems to be better tolerated. Now, the question is, would I do it before a sunlight regimen like TAS-102 plus Bev? And the answer is no, I would not. I think the data is stronger and better right now for TAS-102 Bev. I'm assuming that they're probably moving this up front as rapidly as they can, you know. And what I would think is in the future is that I think, as Kristen pointed out, regorafenib is more of a multi-targeted agent. You know, if that's good, it's multi-targeted. If it's bad, it's dirty. I'm not certain those other targets really are helping us. and are just causing toxicity. So what I would see is I think that fewer and fewer people, even more than nowadays, will be getting regorafenib. So I think it will be chemotherapy, more chemotherapy, maybe EGFR if you can. I'm not talking about the targeted ones. Then probably TAS-102 Bev, then fruquintinib, and then if the person's still alive and say, and you don't have a trial, well, we do have this other, you know, until someone does a trial and said that none of the regorafenib patients who got fruquintinib, you know, benefited, I think then they'll be throwing regorafenib at the people or hospice.
I got to say, you know, if I've heard these arguments back and forth over the last few years, you know, regorafenib versus TAS-102, a lot of times I'm sitting back wondering whether either one of them was worth giving. You know, it's hard to say the data. When you look at the data, it never got me that excited. One of the things about the sunlight is I feel like you were saying, Kristen, we had this sort of, you know, it wasn't that well defined what the benefits are. Now you see that there's some, you know, some benefit that you can actually trace. So I just feel better in general about treating with anything at that point when I saw those data. All right, let's get into MSI high. We'll touch on that a little bit, but making it a little more complicated, Dr. Jasani's patients also BRAF V600E mutant, not a rare occurrence. Here's the case.
This is a pleasant 79-year-old farmer treated with a BRAF inhibitor, irinotecan and cetuximab, and developed severe diarrhea with ileus, prolonged hospitalization, and treatment was stopped. And at that point, he had progressive disease radiographically with a CEA of 600. In October of 2019, I initiated pembrolizumab, and he has had an excellent response since then. Questions I have is the coexistence of a BRAF and MSI high. How often do they coexist? And what is the first line optimal regimen in these patients? And how do you sequence the therapy in these patients? He's been on pembro now for a year and a half, doing well. His severe colitis causes to stop therapy for 6 months, but on rechallenge, he has been fine. He's doing well at 79. He farms all day, and he feels well with a good quality of life. He continues to work on the farm. He's one of these tough guys that won't talk about his symptoms. So when he called with diarrhea, we figured it was something real. We hydrated him and then put him in a local hospital there, scoped him, and treated him with steroids. Luckily, he responded to the steroids, cooled everything off, did not require anything more, and then rechallenged within about 3.5 to 4 months of being off therapy.
So, Kristen, I had to take a deep breath when I thought about a 79-year-old man getting rechallenged after having been hospitalized for autoimmune colitis, but he seems to be cruising along. He seems like a pretty tough patient. Any thoughts about this? You know, this patient, I think, was treated when kind of in the beginning of our consciousness about MSI high and BRAF. We've done tons of surveys. You know, our way of doing things is we find 20 investigators and say, what do you do? And we've seen in the last few years, when we say, what comes first? Most people say IO in these patients. How often do you see both of these abnormalities? Are they any different essentially than each one separately? And how do you decide what comes first?
Yeah, so it's pretty common to have them concomitantly. I think up to about 20% will have both. 20% of the MSI high will also have a BRAF V600E mutation. And so, you know, one of the bigger reasons behind that is, you know, the sporadic MSI high patient tends to have a BRAF mutation because of the MLH1 hypermethylation versus a Lynch patient who would be BRAF wild type. So in the older patient, you know, this is actually more expected. It doesn't seem to prognostically impact or detract from the potential response to immunotherapy. And I do choose immunotherapy first, largely because of that potential for that very durable response and even functional cure in some patients. So not everybody will respond. There are about 30% in the KEYNOTE-177 data who had progressive disease as best response. That's when I switched to BRAF-targeted therapy if needed.
Randy, any comments? Also, the issue of duration of IO in the MSI situation when the patient's responding. We have a little RTP poll we do every webinar to see how long it's going to take to get a question about cell-free DNA in the chat room. I just saw one now, 551. So it took this time. Usually it's about ding, 15 to 18 minutes usually, but it wasn't, you know. So this Jeffrey wants to know about Natera with stage 4 disease, in addition to your thoughts about this case, Randy.
Okay, let me kind of go in order. One, I agree with everything that my colleague said, and I agree 100% because IO, when it works for a long time, and you look at that tail of the curve, and it is really flat. And so, and this person is getting out now to that tail of the curve. So I would say that it is, you know, unlikely for this person to progress, and we don't know because it's only been so long. I don't know, 10 years, 15 years. For BRAF treatment, unfortunately, you know, duration of response, even when you get a response, is short. And I'm not aware that patients who have MSI do any better with BRAF-directed therapy. So BRAF-directed therapy is better than non-BRAF-directed therapy and MSS, but they still don't do that well. This is a hero. This is one of that 40% or so people who are doing really well. Now back to ctDNA. I think that in general, the best place to use ctDNA goes back to the dynamic trial, which is actually, this is where I use it the most, which is in stage 2 to see whether someone should have adjuvant therapy or not. Now, there are some trials, I'm thinking like the Gritstone, like the GO10 trial, where they're using it as an endpoint. That's a vaccine trial and trying to see that as an earlier endpoint in earlier trials rather than waiting. Clinically, I think the only place where it's been most useful has been, as was discussed earlier, was with EGFR reintroduction, is that if you have someone who had a good response to an anti-EGFR antibody and is now on something else, and there's you know, that you have loss of those, you know, resistance mechanisms, I think that's really useful. I just had a patient I'm waiting to put on a cell therapy trial. One of my colleague's patients, he's been on actually Cape Bev for a long time. His ctDNA, which I didn't tell them to check, is going way, way up. And so we're all set to go ahead and treat him with cell therapy. He actually, his tumor shrank a little bit after, I don't know why, after 6 months on maintenance. So it's the scan that's important. And so I don't use it otherwise, other than that.
So, Kristen, any comments on, it seems like, the age-old question, or that we can't seem to crack, about MS stable disease and immunotherapy? In your talk, you mentioned the so-called BOT-BAL study, kind of an ipi-nivo PD-1 CTLA-4. Thank goodness they came up with this abbreviation, because I don't think I could begin to pronounce these
drugs. They're
hard. Well, I guess BOT-BAL, ipi-nivo, you know, same kind of thing. But anyhow, any thoughts about whether any strategies for MS stable disease, Kristen?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the most promising right now, though we've been disappointed before with obviously immunotherapy and MSS disease. So it's really tricky. We'll have to wait and see what the data shows. In the BOT-BAL study, it's excluding patients with liver mets, which unfortunately is the majority of our patients. But we've clearly seen from other immunotherapy studies that the patients with liver mets don't tend to respond. So I think that was actually a good exclusion criteria. I will mention, since we're on the subject of BRAF, that there is an ongoing SWOG study, 2107, looking at MSS BRAF mutated patients in the second line and beyond, actually doing encorafenib, cetuximab, and nivolumab, plus or minus nivolumab. It's a randomized phase 2. So that's an interesting study that I think will be, is based on preclinical data that shows that there may be this phenotypic switch from proficient mismatch repair to deficient mismatch repair phenotype in the BRAF patients specifically. And there's been a lot of investigation to immunotherapy with BRAF, even for the patients who are not MSI high. So that's one avenue that looks intriguing for sure. And otherwise, you know, we still don't know. We saw LEAP was a negative study, unfortunately, at ESMO GI this year. So Lenva, Pembro in the MSS patient population. So, you know, I think it's probably we need to do more studies that are not just in all comers, but have a little bit more understanding of which patients are more likely to respond, even though we're tempted to enroll everyone with MSS disease.
But LEAP was positive in that same group of patients at a hazard ratio of 0.65 in patients without liver mets. That's going to be a crowded space. What is it about liver mets? Is it there are people have published about an immune siphon that it takes those immune cells out and sucks them up? I don't know, but the data is the data. But those patients will be fought over for trials.
Very true.
All right. Let's finish out with two more quick cases. We'll just ask you for your comment. These are both BREF cases. Dr. Dayani, Dr. Ozzy, here are the cases.
The tumor was BRAF V600E positive, microsatellite stable. And obviously, we did the radiation to the brain to control the brain mets. And she didn't want chemo at that time. We were fortunate to be able to get encorafenib and cetuximab approved for her. She had a very, very rapid response. 6 weeks into treatment, they sent me a picture from the local mall where they were shopping and having lunch. So she really had a clinical benefit for about 4 months to the regimen, but then her CA started to rise again and she had some more systemic weakness, fatigue. And we ultimately had to switch her to second line FOLFOX.
She was treated with FOLFOX bevacizumab. She developed 6 month in progressive disease and was switched to the encorafenib cetuximab regimen. In terms of these patients with BRAF V600E mutations, would your go-to regimen for first line be the FOLFOX and bevacizumab? And would you go with a regimen with a BRAF inhibitor in second line? Or would you prefer other regimens? And in terms of our patient experience, pretty significant skin toxicity, and it was a challenge to manage that with this patient. I wanted to see if our faculty have any recommendation in terms of the toxicity management for this regimen.
So, Kristen, first-line therapy, BRAF. Does BRAF therapy work in the brain? And what's your experience, particularly with dermatologic toxicity?
Yeah, so first line depends on the functionality of the patient and the tumor burden. I tend to give more FOLFOX Uri-Bev if the patient is young or has a high tumor burden and I think they can tolerate it. I, of course, de-escalate to a more maintenance-like regimen, after a few months. Of course, we have the Breakwater study, which is the first line FOLFOX plus encorafenib cetuximab. So I preferentially at my institution would enroll the patient on that. So that is open across the country. Dermatologic toxicities, they can be challenging. I interestingly find sometimes that doing encorafenib cetuximab is better than cetuximab alone. So there could be some mitigating effects there. But having to keep out a lookout for the BRAF skin toxicities, making sure that, dermatology, if you have a good dermatologist, looking out for these patients, but also the usual steroids and other things for anti-EGFR related skin toxicity is really important. And there was a third question that I can't remember what it was. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's like a memory test. I give it to Randy. So Randy, CNS activity of BRAF, the lung people, to me, they started this paradigm of asymptomatic brain mets give targeted therapy. What do we know about CNS activity of BRAF therapy in colon cancer? If you had a patient with small brain mets or asymptomatic, would you try targeted therapy for radiation, particularly whole brain?
Wow, you have asked me a question that I have absolutely no experience with. Thank goodness that we don't get brain metastases that frequently. I mean, it's not breast or lung, where this is so horrible. And usually the patients with colorectal cancer outside of BRAF, for example, it's the patients who've done well for an incredibly long period of time and have lived long enough in order to do that. I would say that I think it's reasonable to do because BRAF patients tend to do really poorly. So it's not just the brain. We know that patients with brain metastases, that blood-brain barrier is often broken down. So especially for small molecules, I think it would be a very reasonable. But Kristen, I don't have any data. Do you have any data or experience with that?
No. Yeah, I've you know, clinically seen maybe some penetration into the brain, but it's hard to know in a kind of non-controlled.
I think small molecules would be more likely to do that rather than antibodies. Mm-hmm. But now back to the, let me see your other ones. Again, I'm failing the memory test.
No, you got it. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Skin toxicity. Yeah,
toxicity. Okay. So, you know, we've been working with this since I was working with panitumumab before it was called panitumumab. And actually, Edith Mitchell and dermatologists had worked on it. I think one of the key things, the points are, one, I think maybe Christian, you pointed out that the combo tends to be better than single agent. And that's actually been shown. And in fact, someone that you may know, Tony Rebus, has been specifically looking in the melanoma, you know, looking at topical sort of inhibitors, with a company, and we've been part of those trials. I think the other thing for toxicity management is early. And so you should start, you know, your treatment. And that's what the STEP trial did show, was that, starting, you know, a tetracycline, starting, steroid creams, if, you know, starting things with really early rather than waiting till they have late. Where they have some pretty good, like grade 3 rash. And I think that's really one of the more important take home messages. But the combination more tolerable.
Mm-hmm. So, Kristen and Randy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really learned a lot from you, as we always do. Audience, thank you for attending. Get some rest tonight and come on back tomorrow night. And we're going to tackle localized non small cell. Want to hear what they think about targeted therapy too, and this new adjuvant ALK trial, supposedly positive. That could be shaking things up a little bit. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Kristen. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
Have a good one.